Good evening, or morning, or afternoon, whenever you listen to this. We are
pretty much just hi.
We are back with another killer podcast, but actually this week, mine is not a killer podcast. I was going to end up going with Ted Bundy, but when I was looking up stuff about Ted Bundy, the case had been reviewed and talked about and reviewed and talked about, like, thousands of times.
Oh yeah, it's a very famous case.
There's just been so much said about it that I felt like I am not yet ready to give my perspective on it because I feel like anything I say, everybody's already going to know.
Yeah, so, that's fair, but everyone's perspective is unique when it comes to talking about things.
Also true. I just felt like this week I didn't want to cover it. There's just so much media coverage on it. There's so much documentaries and movies coming out. I went with something a little different because I was feeling like doing something that maybe not everybody has heard about quite yet.
Mm-hmm.
Mine is somewhat famous of a case, but not really, and it does not involve anybody getting killed. This is a true crime podcast. Thus, our title is our killer podcast, but it's a true crime podcast, so I went with a kidnapping.
It's kind of an innuendo. It's like, it's basically our killer podcast as a, like, it's super cool, but also, like, we talk about things that involve true crime and, like, murders. So
this one has nothing to do with murder this week. There was no murder in this. It's just a really, honestly, awful case of these poor three women who got abducted in Cleveland, Ohio in 2002 to 2004. And were kidnapped for up to 11 years.
So. Yep, but don't worry, guys. I came in strong with a really long, awful murder case. So don't worry, you're still getting your murder fix.
So I'm going to go ahead and start with talking about the case of the Cleveland, Ohio kidnapping, I guess. A lot of people call it the case of Ariel Castro, who is the kidnapper. I did not feel like that was
not a good title, really, because, well, you shouldn't be giving him the publicity.
Gianna, stop interrupting because that's what I was going to say.
Sorry!
What I was going to say, though, was just that I don't feel like saying the case of Ariel Castro does anybody justice. This man was a god-awful man. He was horrible, and what he did to these women was not okay, so I don't want to give him the glorification of saying that this is his case, because it's not. It's these women's cases, and these women's names are Michelle Knight, Amanda Berry, and Georgina De Jesus. So we're going to talk more about them and their story than we are going to talk about him, because he's honest to God a butthole. I mean, I would say an asshole, but really not supposed to curse, even though I just said it. might not. Because honest to God, if this is like a real true crime podcast, we're going to talk about the nasty. We're going to talk about the awful stuff, because people need to understand how bad this stuff is. This stuff, you can have a fascination with Criminal Mind, and you can have a fascination with all of this stuff, but there's absolutely no reason to glorify what has happened. Absolutely no reason to glorify the people that have done these things.
Mm-hmm. It's more about learning than, you know,
I personally look at true crime because I would love to have a degree in criminal psychology, and that's what I'm going for. So this is why this interests me so much, is because I'm like, why does this person's mind work like this? I also want to go into victim studies, things like that. So, that aside, let's get into this case. I have notes organized in such different ways. I have a timeline, and then of the basic events of this case, and then I have, like, how life was in the captivity. So we're going to start with victims, timeline, then how life was during captivity. So the victims were Michelle Knight, who disappeared at age 21 in August of 2002 from Lorraine Avenue in Cleveland. Her family actually believed that she'd ran away because she was 20 years old, or I said 21, sorry guys, she's 20 when she was kidnapped. And she lost custody of her son, so her family believed that she just, like, ran away, and she was really not publicized as much as the other two victims, and that was really sad. Because her family really didn't look for her. She did not have a really good relationship with her family.
That sucks.
Yeah. So then there's Amanda Berry, who was the second of this kidnapping. She disappeared at the age of 16 in April of 2003. from Lorraine Avenue as well. And she actually, a big part of her entire story is that she had Ariel Castro's daughter in captivity. So that's...
Wait, hold up.
He impregnated her and she had his child and raised her in captivity.
Oh, we're gonna get sorry. More. I was confused because the way that you originally said it made it seem like she had his daughter in captivity, like as in like he had a daughter already and she took her. And I was really confused, but then you rephrased it and I understood. That's my bad.
Okay. So then there's Georgina De Jesus, but she really went by Gina De Jesus. So Gina, she disappeared at the age of 14 in April of 2004, also from Lorraine Avenue. Something that really freaked out this community was that they were all taken from relatively, like, the same spot. And that was just, like, really scary. Like, people didn't want their kids walking home, and it was just, it was a really scary time. That's so such
psychological damage, the people that live there, man.
Yeah, and so onto the timeline, August 22nd of 2002, Michelle Knight was last seen, and the next day she was reported missing. On April 21st, 2003, Amanda Berry was last seen after finishing her shift at Burger King. She worked there as a teenager. In April 2nd, 2004, Gina De Jesus stopped at a payphone with her friend. So she was, like, walking home with a friend. They stopped at a payphone, and they called, I believe it was Jean. No, they called her friend's mom and asked if her friend could stay the night at Gina's house. And her mom said no. And so then they kind of went their separate ways. That was the last time that she was seen before she was abducted.
Mm-hmm.
April of 2005, America's Most Wanted, which was a show during the time, featured Amanda Berry and Gina De Jesus' stories, highlighting that they were taken from almost the exact same spot on Lorraine Avenue. One of the people interviewed was actually Arlene Castro, and she was the daughter of Ariel Castro, because get this, the person that Gina was talking, the friend that Gina was with that wanted to stay the night, was Ariel Castro's daughter. So she was the friend that last saw her. And
ooh.
What this actually has to connect to is Ariel Castro lured Gina into his car by saying something along the lines of, oh, I'm Arlene's dad. Like, I'll take you home. Like, you don't need to walk. Like, I'm on my way that way anyways. And lured her into the car. And that was the end of that. So in April of 2012, Grimaldi
I've never seen the name.
She was former partner of Ariel Castro. I believe she was Arlene Castro's mother, but she had actually died. And she, an interesting part of her is that she accused Castro of domestic violence and abducting their daughters, but charges were dismissed due to technicalities. So that was, yeah. In May...
That's such an abrupt ending to the sentence, sorry.
Well, I mean, there's not much more to say about that. She died, and during her lifetime, she'd accused Ariel Castro of domestic violence, and Ariel Castro had abducted their daughter, Arlene, but that was more of a domestic dispute than an actual kidnapping, because it was his daughter. And she wasn't, like, never heard from again. So, May 6, 2013, Amanda Berry screamed for help through a crack of the front door at 2207 Seymour Avenue. Angel Cordero and a neighbor, Charles Ramsey, kicked open the door, and Amanda Berry carried out her 6-year-old daughter across the street and called 911. This was 2013. This was 10 years after Amanda Berry was kidnapped. When the police arrived, they found them. They found De Jesus and Knight both in the house, and three brothers were detained for the women's disappearance. It was Ariel Castro, Pedro Castro, and O'Neill Castro. I think that had to do with the title of the house, whose name it was in. But they obviously released Pedro Castro and O'Neill Castro because Ariel Castro was the person that kidnapped them.
Got you.
So, May 9th of 2013, Ariel Castro was charged with 4 counts of kidnapping and 3 counts of rape. His bail was set at $8 million. On June 7th of 2013, Ariel Castro was indicted on 329 counts, and that was 100 split up. That was 139 counts of rape, 177 counts of kidnapping, 7 counts of gross sexual imposition, 3 counts of felonious assault, and 2 counts of aggravated murder. The murders were for the termination of one of the victim's pregnancies, and 1 count of possession of criminal tools. I am going to get into more details later. I'm just giving y'all a brief timeline because I don't really know how to like execute talking about this without getting through a timeline, so y'all kind of understand what I'm talking about later.
Yeah.
So on July 12th, 2013, a grand jury issues a fresh indictment charging Ariel Castro with 977 counts. That was split into 512 counts of kidnapping, 446 counts of rape, 7 of gross sexual imposition, 6 counts of felonious assault, 3 counts of child endangerment, 2 counts of aggravated murder, in which Ariel Castro is accused of intentionally causing the termination of a pregnancy, and 1 count of possession of criminal tools. July 26, 2013, Ariel Castro agrees to the plea deal, which recommends that he be sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
Mm-hmm.
The deal agrees that he plead guilty to 937 counts.
Holy crap.
Well, that was, like, 40 less than what the grand jury wanted.
Well, I know, but, like, whoa, 930 counts?
Yeah, he kind of, like, held 3 girls kidnapped for 10 years and raped them and beat them and starved them.
That's just a very large number. Like, that's a disgusting number for one human being to have.
Yeah.
Like, I think anything more than, like, you know, one is bad.
He really should have gotten more. This is just what they could count him on. All they really needed to, because after this, on August 1st, 2013, Ariel Castro was sentenced to life in prison plus 1,000 years. September 3rd, 2013, Ariel Castro died by suicide in his prison cell. And that's where we're going to stop for now on the timeline. He did commit suicide. Yeah, I know. He was a very big coward. So we're going to go into talking about the captivity.
Yeah.
And I will be putting a trigger warning in the description. So this is y'all's trigger warning. If you have not read that, this is going to be talking about rape. This is going to be talking about abuse. This is going to be talking about what these women went through in captivity. So, and I will not be holding back on the what I've researched. So, Ariel Castro kidnapped Knight and he took her up. So when Ariel Castro kidnapped Michelle Knight, he took her upstairs, tied her hands and feet together, pulled her up using her hands, feet, and neck. He left her there for 3 days. So what he basically did was he had some sort of like lift thing in a room and he tied her up, and she was tied. She was dangling from the ceiling by her hands, feet, neck, and I believe maybe her torso. He left her there for 3 days without food. Also, these women kept diaries, that the prosecutors used at Ariel Castro's sentencing, that wrote things of that, how they were, they speak of forced sexual conduct, of being locked in a dark room, anticipating the next session of abuse. They had dreams of someday escaping and reuniting with family and being chained. They were chained to walls. They were held like prisoners. Emotional abuse. He threatened to kill them several times. They were treated like animals.
Mm-hmm.
Continuous abuse. Just desiring freedom. And these women were locked in upstairs bedrooms. They were forced to use plastic toilets that were emptied, like, not frequently at all. They were fed one meal a day and allowed to shower twice a week at the very most. He starved them. When Michelle Knight was released, or not released, escaped, she was 80 pounds.
80 pounds? It's a 20-something-year-old woman?
She was, no, by the time she was released, she was 30.
As a 30-something-year-old woman?
She's your height. I believe she's about 5 foot.
Oh, jeez. I mean, that's...
But 80 pounds is still not
It's good. Not... It's not terrible for a really short person, but that's not good either.
Michelle Knight told the police that Errol Castro had impregnated her at least 5 times and induced miscarriages each time through beatings, hitting her with dumbbells, punching her, slamming her against walls. He also starved her. Michelle Knight's grandmother told reporters that she would require facial reconstruction surgery due to beatings that she endured and lost hearing in one ear. At one point, she had a pet dog while in captivity, but Errol Castro killed it by snapping its neck after it bit him
while trying to
protect Knight.
But good boy, though.
DeJesus told law enforcement she was raped but did not believe that she was ever impregnated. On Christmas Day in 2006, Errol Castro allegedly ordered Michelle Knight to assist in the birth of Amanda Berry's child, which took place in a small inflatable swimming pool, and he threatened to kill her if the baby did not survive the labor. At one point, the baby stopped breathing, but Knight was able to resuscitate her. Castro occasionally took her out of the house, including to visit his mother. She called him daddy and Castro's mother, grandmother. This is Amanda Berry's child, daughter of Errol Castro and Amanda Berry.
I'm kind of confused why he let Amanda Berry's child live, but all of those other...
Because she was his child.
Well...
So it was his daughter. Like, he didn't want to hurt her. He had no intention of hurting her.
Oh, wait, hold on.
Never hurt.
Amanda Berry was Errol Castro's daughter?
No. Amanda Berry was the second kidnapped woman. Errol Castro impregnated Amanda Berry, but did not induce a miscarriage. He let her have the child, and Amanda Berry raised the child in captivity, but Errol Castro would take his daughter out of the house. His daughter did not know that his mother was being kidnapped. Like, she didn't get it.
No, what I was confused on is why he let Amanda Berry keep the kid when he impregnated the other woman and made them have...
Yeah, I'm gonna get to that, don't worry.
That was my confusion. I was like, why?
Yeah. So, he just told everybody that it was his granddaughter. Anyways, so Amanda Berry taught her daughter how to read and write. They had a little school. They turned one of the bedrooms into a school, and her daughter didn't know that any of this was what it was. She was just raised this way. It was just what she knew life to be. So, according to a statement from Cleveland police, officers visited Castro's home only once following the kidnaps to discuss an unrelated incident. Castro did not appear to be home at the time and was later interviewed elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Neighbors claim to have called the police about suspicious activity observed in the home. Police have said that they have no record of any such calls. Castro's son, Anthony, reported that there were certain areas of the house that were inaccessible due to being locked. He also mentioned an occasion 3 weeks before the women's escape when Castro had asked him if Amanda would ever be found. So about 3 weeks before they were actually rescued, like, Errol Castro asked Anthony, which was like, Anthony was, wait, who was Anthony again? Hold on, I totally missed that. He had asked Anthony, do you think she'll ever be found? And Anthony told Castro it was very likely that she was dead. And then Castro responds with like, oh, really? You think so? Like, he was a weird dude, and we don't like him.
Okay.
So, basically, I watched several interviews about Amanda Berry, Gina DeJesus, and Michelle Knight. Michelle Knight was the first person to be kidnapped, and he did treat her worse than he had treated any of the other victims. He abused her worse. He beat her worse. He raped her more. He beat, like, her pregnancies into miscarriages. He killed a dog that he gave her. He truly treated her worse than he treated Amanda Berry or Gina DeJesus. Now, that is in no way at all saying that they did not live through absolute hell, because they mm-hmm. did.
But there are different fluctuations in that sense of the word.
Yes. They, as in Gina DeJesus and Amanda Berry, have both admitted, like, yes, he treated Michelle worse. And they don't know why. Michelle believes that it's because she never broke down. She never, like, she kind of showed him almost sometimes, like, I'm not, like, scared of you type thing. And for that, she thinks that that's why she was mistreated more. Mm-hmm. So, the reason that they were rescued or escaped was actually Amanda Berry. What happened was, so, there would be several occasions throughout the 10 years that they were in captivity in which Ariel Castro would leave a door open. He would leave something unlocked. And the girls would kind of, like, look, and if they didn't see him, they might, like, try to step out. Mm-hmm. And then he would be like, no, he would beat them because he was watching for them to step out. And that was his way of controlling them. So whenever they saw an open door, they didn't even think to go near it. They were like, it's a trap. He's waiting for me to go there. So that was his way of controlling them.
Yeah, psychological abuse. Talk about Pavlov's dog.
So, what happened was one day, you know, he would just leave doors. And that was also a way for him to not have to worry about stuff. He would just leave doors unlocked. And he knew that they weren't going to try to mm-hmm. escape. Well, there is one day that he left the door open. It wasn't chained. There was not locked. And Amanda Berry didn't even have any intent of leaving. But her daughter came back in. And Amanda was like, hey, where's your daddy? And she was like, oh, daddy went to see his mom. And in that moment, Amanda was like, there is an extremely good chance that Ariel Castro had actually left the house.
Mm-hmm. Instead of, like, so, the daughter being like, oh, daddy told me to go tell you this. And, like, lying.
So she knew that there was a pretty decent chance that he wasn't there. Mm-hmm. And in that moment, she decided to just absolutely go for it. And she ran and went to the door. Now, she was able to open the front door, but then there was, like, this screen door. And it was locked from the outside, I think. And there was, like on the screen on the bottom, there was, like, it was broken. So she had crawled down, put her arm through it, and she was absolutely just screaming. She was like, help me, somebody help me, like, anybody help me. And she was just screaming for her life because she knew in that moment, Ariel Castro could come home.
Mm-hmm.
And this was her moment. So some neighbors saw her. And they broke down the door. And so she ran across the street with the neighbors and called 911. And there's a recording of it. It's like, hi, my name's Amanda Berry. I've been missing for 10 years. But I'm here. Like, I'm free.
Like,
now.
I'm alive. And yeah, that's probably an immense wave of relief.
And her name was very famous around this community. Like, the whole town knew that she was missing. All of Cleveland knew that this girl was missing. So the police also knew who she was instantly, like, dispatched. So, after that, police entered the house, found Gina DeJesus and Michelle Knight. And from then on, they got plenty and plenty, probably never enough, but a lot of intense therapy, hospital visits. Michelle Knight was said to not supposed to make it another few days of living because she was so starved. She had a bacterial infection. But she persevered and she fought through. She said that what drove her to do that was the strength she gained from wanting to see her son again one day.
Mm-hmm.
And they all ended up coming out with books about their experience. Michelle Knight came out with one, and Gina DeJesus and Amanda Berry co-wrote a book together and had it published. So that's kind of where they mm-hmm. are now. Ariel Castro is
good.
He committed suicide in his prison cell, I believe, by hanging himself using his bed sheets. And that was about a month after he was, like, in his first month of being incarcerated for, like, his whole life plus 1,000 years.
Yeah.
And that is the end of the case of the Cleveland kidnapping that kind of took the – like, if you look up the Cleveland, Ohio kidnapping, this will come up. It is a pretty well-covered case. There's several, like – shows covered this
in the
case.
Sense it was of very well. Murderers or rapists or awful people committing suicide when they've been incarcerated, that is just, that's such a coward's way out. Not to say that like suicide in general is a coward's way out, but for those people it is, because they're completely ignoring their verdict, the justice system. You are supposed to serve until life because of how awful you are as a human being. You don't get to choose that other route. That's not your choice, and it shouldn't be.
You know, I don't think that they really care about the justice
system.
Well,
no, I know, but it's just aggravating. Because it's like, you put these people through such awful things, you put the family through such awful things, and then a month after being convicted, you do that. You didn't suffer for nearly long enough. It's just, ugh.
Yeah. So that is the case of the Cleveland, Ohio kidnapping. And yeah, I think on that note, we are going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back to discuss Gianna's case of the week. Mm-hmm. So.
It'll be pretty cool.
Bye, guys. And we're back.
Yes, we are. Also, to clarify, when I say something is super fun, I don't mean in the traditional sense of fun. I just mean like it's interesting. I in no way endorse murderers. I promise. All right. So, mine's a little bit of a doozy. Besides like our kind of turn system, the reason that I'm going second is because mine is longer. So basically I am going to do the story of Peter Curtin. He is a German serial killer, so let's just get into it. So born May 26th, 1883, so it's an oldie but a goodie. Peter Curtin was known as the vampire of Dusseldorf, I don't know, I don't speak German, or the Dusseldorf monster. This deprived human being was also described by Carl Berg, who was a forensic scientist as well as a psychologist from Germany, as the king of sexual perverts. Oh. So, with that little tidbit, let's begin. So, Peter was born into a poor family, but their parents were heavily abusive to all 13 of their children. So Peter was the third out of the 13 children, but with two not surviving childhood, he officially became the eldest. So basically his two older siblings died and then he became the eldest sibling. So this entire family lived. So keep in mind, this is with his parents, like 13 people living in one household, one bedroom apartment. That's all they have. That's not a lot of room at all. So his parents were both alcoholics, and often while they were in one of their drunk fits, warning, we're also going to put this in description, but before I continue, if you are sensitive, like trigger warning, you're sensitive to themes of alcoholism, rape, sexual abuse, all of that stuff, you probably don't want to listen to my story because it's not good. Anyways, to continue. So basically, when their parents were in these drunk fits, he would force children to line up while he made his wife strip naked and have sex with him while they watched. So basically, he would line up his kids in a row, tell his wife to get naked, and then he would rape her, essentially. Oof. Yeah. So and they would be forced to watch. If they left, they would be beaten. So, after being sent to jail for 15 months in 1894, his father, for repeatedly sexually assaulting his eldest daughter, who was 13, Curtin's mother then files for divorce, remarries, and moves to Dusseldorf. They were originally living in another city in Germany, but a lot of the, pretty much all of the crimes take place in Dusseldorf for Peter. So, in 1888, 5-year-old Curtin attempted to drown one of his friends as they played. So, imagine a 5-year-old taking another 5-year-old and shoving his head underneath the water on purpose. So, at 9 years old, with the lack of an actually good father figure, Peter befriends a local dog catcher who lived in the same building as him. This dog catcher introduces him to something called bestiality. So, basically, that is having sexual relations with animals. And as Peter kind of accompanied the man on his tours to catch animals, he saw how the dog catcher tortured and killed most of the animals he caught, and Peter almost immediately began to do the same. So as the dog catcher would catch these animals, he would torture and then kill them, and then he taught Peter how to, and Peter loved it. So he was a smart child, but due to excessive abuse from his father, his grades slipped as he tried to avoid going home and therefore didn't go to school for days or weeks at a time. So in order to avoid being abused, he would completely avoid the whole household and school to begin with. So this was the beginning of his petty crime streak, which was initially started as a way of feeding and clothing himself while he lived on the street. So he would steal food for himself and clothes, but that's just kind of where he starts. And so, according to Peter Curtin himself, his first murder was committed at the age of 9. He allegedly shoved one of his school friends who was unable to swim off of a log raft or a bridge. It's differing information on different articles, but either way, he still shoved someone into the water. And when another boy tried to save the first one, Curtin held the second boy's head underwater and both boys drowned. So, because Curtin was the only one who witnessed it, both deaths were ruled an accident because no one thought a 9-year-old would drown two boys. So they, but it's also not confirmed whether or not he really murdered them. So their deaths will never truly be solved or avenged for because it's alleged. They don't know if he's telling the truth or not, or if he's just trying to seem bigger and badder than he is. So, at 13, while he had a girlfriend, he took to sexually assaulting animals because she refused to engage in intercourse and realized that he could only feel satisfied after he stabbed and mutilated the animal. So, as he would have sex with whatever it is, he would stab the animal at increasingly faster rates. So, in 1897, Peter left school altogether at the age of 14 to become a molder. So I didn't really figure out what a molder was. I'm assuming it's kind of like pottery, but I might be completely wrong. So he was an apprentice because that's what they did back then. You did apprenticeships. You still do that now, but not as often. So he was an apprentice for 2 years before he stole all of the money in the house of his boss and ran away from home again. So after being arrested for this crime and serving a month in prison, he immediately resumed his crimes later that year in 1899. So this is the next little tidbit of information is the lead up to the big year. You're going to figure out what the big year is in just a second. So just know that it's not good stuff. So his first alleged attempted murder was less than 3 months later in 1899. So he states that he picked up a young girl of 17 or 18 years old and convinced her to accompany him to a beautiful garden park named Hofgarten. It's really pretty. If you look up pictures, it's a gorgeous park. So immediately you would think that a handsome young boy would just want to take you for a walk. He did not want to take her for a walk. He states that this is where he sexually assaulted her before strangling her with his bare hands. However, there are no records that show that his story is true, so if this assault did take place, the victim survived. But they don't know. In 1904, Peter Curtin was drafted into the Imperial German Army, where he served in the 98th Infantry Regiment before deserting like a coward. He began to commit arson and watch from a distance as his fires were put out by emergency services because he got a sexual thrill out of that. So he has been quoted as saying that these fires were placed as hoping to burn sleeping homeless people alive, who would sleep in barns or haylofts where the fires were set. There was a word in one of the articles that called them tramps, and I've never heard of that. So basically, if you ever see a word where it's like, oh, they wanted to get rid of the tramps, it means homeless people or migrants or just people who don't have a home, pretty much.
Yeah.
I didn't know that, but I do now, which is interesting. But anyways, so on the 25th of May of 1913, a 9-year-old girl named Christine Klein became Peter Curtin's first murder victim. He strangled her before cutting her throat, being excited by the sound of blood dripping from her wounds.
Wow.
So, less than 2 months later, he broke into a home in Dusseldorf and strangled a 17-year-old girl named Gertrude Franken, killing her in the same manner as Christine. So, strangulation and then cutting her throat. He was arrested on July 14th and imprisoned for 6 years for arson attacks and burglaries. However, his refusal to listen extended his time by 2 years. So while he was imprisoned, it wasn't for these crimes because they didn't know he committed them. So upon his release in 1921, it appeared that he had gotten his life together by marrying August Scharf, who was 3 years his senior. This wife that he just married was convicted of shooting her fiance to death.
Oh, so, well, they're perfect for each other.
They're super perfect for each other, except it doesn't end well. They had a healthy relationship together. He had a regular job and became active in politics. So normal people stuff, you know, not having sex with pigs and stabbing them, right? So, however, after it's discovered by his wife that he's been cheating on her, she goes to the police about his behavior, and he serves 6 months of an 18-month sentence for solicitation of a prostitute, stuff like that. Just not the stuff that he was actually doing. I mean, he was doing that, but, like, not the bad stuff. So this stint in prison is what most people who have studied this case believe is what caused the atrocities of 1929. So, are you ready?
Yep.
Alrighty. I don't think you are. Here we go. February 3rd, 1929, Peter stalked an older woman named Apolliona Kuhn. I don't know how to pronounce these names because they're all German names. I'm sorry. He grabbed her by her coat after leaping from behind a bush, screaming at her not to scream, before he stabbed her 24 times with scissors. She was stabbed so forcefully that the scissors hit bone. Mm. This woman survived.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's good.
On February 8th, Curtin strangled a 9-year-old girl named Rosa Oliger before stabbing her in her stomach, heart, head, and genitals. He then dragged her into the bushes and left her body there for several hours before lighting it on fire. There were worse details to this specific instance, but I didn't feel comfortable saying them because they are truly disgusting. So if you do want to read more about that, because he did worse things to her than that, you can go read it on Wikipedia or any of the links that I give Tay for research. But
what was his name again?
His name is Peter Curtin, and the girl's name was Rosa Oliger, which was Ohliger. But yeah, it's that one's particularly. They're all bad, but what he did to her was just awful. Anyways, so February 13th, 45-year-old mechanic Rudolf Scheer was stabbed 20 times. After the scene was discovered by the police, he, meaning Peter, came back to the scene and told the police that he had heard of the event via telephone, which was a lie. The police did not question this.
Wait, where do I find the thing about Rosa?
It's on Wikipedia. I went to, it's in a Wikipedia article on the Vampire of Dusseldorf. Basically, if you look up his, one of his, if just Command F, Rosa Oleger, Oleger, and you'll find her. It's, her last name is Oligier. If you hear her suddenly gasp, you know why. It's, it's just awful. So do you want me to wait until you're done reading that, or?
I literally can't find it because I'm on my phone.
You somewhere. Can't find it? Okay. No. You can read it. You can read it later. It's just, Anyways, on with more murders. So, while there are four attempted known strangulations on women between March and July of 1929, his next victims did not happen till August 11th. So basically, he would try to murder these people and then wouldn't. Like, because like what he attributes it to is he achieved sexual release before he killed them. So he let them go. His whole thing was about release for him.
That's so, a lot of murders. Mm-hmm. A lot of murders. It's a sexual release. Mm-hmm. It's disgusting, but it's true.
Yeah. So his next victims did not happen until August 11th, where he sexually assaulted, strangled, and stabbed Maria Hahn. In fear of being discovered, he buried Hahn's body before coming back to it weeks later in an attempt to nail her body to a tree in a sort of mock crucifixion to disgust the public. However, her remains were too heavy for him to lift, so he didn't. That was the only reason why.
Wow.
He had a thing where he loved the attention he was getting in the public, even though he, even though they didn't know it was him, he got a thrill out of it because he was known and he wanted to disgust the public as much as he could because they had failed him, so he would fail them, essentially. So, months later, Peter admitted to the murder via a letter to the police where he drew a map to show them where he had buried her body. After this, he changed his weapon to scissors, randomly stabbing an 18-year-old girl, a 30-year-old man, and a 37-year-old woman in the early morning of August 21st. All were wounded severely, but did not die.
Hmm.
On August 4th, Curtin sent 14-year-old Louis Lenzen on an errand to buy him cigarettes in return for money. He had seen her and her sister on their way home from the fair. They were walking by themselves because this was the 1900s. They were just chilling. So he sent her to go buy cigarettes. She's 14. It's fine. He strangled her five-year-old sister, Gertrude Hamacher, before cutting her throat and discarding her body in the bushes so that Luis wouldn't see it when she came back. When Luis returned, Peter strangled her before stabbing her. This is where he bit and sucked blood from her wounds. Neither girl was sexually assaulted, which was a first for him. So, August 25th, Peter repeatedly stabbed a woman named Gertrude Schult after she refused to have sex with him. He essentially went up to her and said, "I want you to have intercourse with me." And she said no, so he dragged her into a place where she wouldn't be seen and stabbed her. So she survived, but was unable to provide a description of Curtin. In September, he attempted to murder more women before using a hammer in most of his next murders or attempted murders. So he switched weapons a lot of times. It was his attempt of kind of throwing the police off his scent, and it kind of worked, but he was also not kind of good at murdering some people because he left a lot of victims alive. But again, a lot of people attain it to him having release before he could kill them, so he just let them go.
I'm so confused. I cannot find this girl's name anywhere.
I swear it exists.
Like, seriously, anywhere. Wait, which category is it?
The category on the Wikipedia page? Yeah. Hold on.
Hammer attack?
No, because her death was before. One second. I need to find this for you.
Sorry, guys. I'm very interested.
It's under 1929. It is the second paragraph.
Oh, that's why I'm not finding it, because I haven't looked under that. Okay, thank you.
The second paragraph, it's just disgusting. He is a disgusting human being. Anyways, I have to go back to my page really quickly. One second, please. Hang in with me, guys. Got it. Okay. So, September 30th, 31-year-old Ida Rueda. Ida Router. I don't know. It's R-E-U-T-E-R. Sorry for my pronunciation.
Oh, what?
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah. That's why I didn't want to say it. It's, yeah. Anyways, so basically 31-year-old Ida Router was persuaded by Curtin to come with him to go for drinks.
What confuses me is he actually, has he not raped any of the girls yet?
No, he has.
He just, oh, he has. That's what I thought. Mm-hmm. Okay.
But he did that anyways. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. It's disgusting. He's a truly gross human being. Anyways, so basically, Ida Router was persuaded by Curtin to come with him for drinks and whatever. And so basically, instead of drinks or whatever, he beat her with a hammer and sexually assaulted her. During the attack, she regained consciousness and begged for her life, and he reacted by bashing her brains in. So basically, he strangled her to the point of unconsciousness. She woke up in the middle of the attack while he was sexually assaulting her, and she said, "Please don't kill me," and he responded with a hammer to her skull. On my birthday, October 11th, 22-year-old servant girl as Elizabeth Dorier went with him for a drink before he hit her in the head repeatedly with a hammer and then left her for dead. She was discovered the next day, but had died from her injuries without waking up from the coma Curtin had placed her in. There, you have to hit someone with considerable force for you to put them in a coma with a hammer. And that is terrifying to me. All of this is terrifying, but that one specifically, and also that no one found her for a day. No one. No one saw a woman lying unconscious on the floor, bleeding, in the middle, anyways. October 25th, he attacked two women with a hammer, with both surviving. The second woman survived simply because Peter broke his hammer during the attack. Again, do you know how hard you have to hit someone to snap a hammer? It was a wooden handle with a metal, like a metal head, but that is so much force. Okay. November 7th, Gertrude Alberman came across the path of Peter, and he strangled her before stabbing her 34 times. So, as a reminder, November was when he sent the letter to reveal the body of Maria Hahn. But he also showed the body of Gertrude Alberman, which was the person I just stated. I think I forgot to mention that Gertrude Alberman was a child. Hold on. Let me make sure I have my facts straight before I tell you that Gertrude was a child, because I think she was another 9-year-old, but I don't remember. One split second. Okay, I was right, but it's worse. Gertrude Alberman was a 5-year-old girl who he grabbed her by the throat, strangled her before stabbing her, and then he basically dropped her to the ground like a china doll, and she didn't make a sound because, you know, she was dead. And he proceeded to stab her 34 times post-mortem. Not post-mortem. Post-mortem. So, yeah. I forgot to, in my notes, I didn't have that she was 5, but I felt like she was younger. So I just wanted to make sure that it was told that her age. Anyways, so in that letter that he had given to reveal the body of Maria Hahn, he also showed where he had put Gertrude Alberman's body, talking about details down to the position of the body. So like how he had left her. An analysis of this letter showed that a similar letter given October 14th was by the same author, which proved that only one man was responsible for all this awfulness. So, how he had left Gertrude Alberman was in a pile of needles, but it was NEETLES, but I don't know what that is, but it was outside of a factory. So I don't think it could be anything good. He propped her up against a wall and positioned her and then left her there, which is just disgusting. So between February and May of 1930, a span of non-fatal hammer attacks were committed by Curtin, where he maimed 10 victims, with some being able to describe the assailant. So before this, Curtin had attacked people with such suddenness and awfulness that they were not able to get a clear picture of who he was, because he didn't wear a mask, he didn't wear a hoodie, he didn't do any of that. He just went after people. So
yeah,
it was odd that no one could see who he was to the police. Anyways, it was odd. And so basically these 10 victims were able to give a description of this person who had been terrorizing the city of Dusseldorf for a year. So on May 14th, 1930, an unknown man came up to a woman named Maria Budlich at the Dusseldorf train station. The man began to lead her to a hotel because she was telling him that she was from another city, she was here for work, and she needed a place to stay. And he told her, hey, I know a great place. And so she became scared when he proposed to take her through a scarcely populated park, and another man came to her aid. So basically, this man who was leading her to the hotel wanted to take her through an area where not a lot of people were, and she, being a very smart woman, was like, hey, no, I'm not going alone with you in that place because that's dangerous. And another man came up to her and was like, hey, is this man bothering you? And she said, yes. And he said, okay, well, not anymore. You're coming with me. Unfortunately for her, the man who came to her aid was Peter Curtin. His ulterior motive was shown when they arrived at Peter's apartment, where he sexually assaulted her and attempted to strangle her. So basically, he told her, hey, you've been through something. Let me get you a drink, something to eat, and then I'll take you where you need to go. And instead, he tried to strangle her, and he sexually assaulted her. When she started screaming, he let her leave. Essentially, he was choking her. She started screaming. He let her go. And then she left. Maria did not report the assault to the police and instead wrote a letter to her friend. But the letter was incorrectly addressed. As a result of it not being correctly addressed, a post office clerk read and delivered the letter on the 19th of May to the proper authorities. So this post office clerk saw that this letter wasn't addressed right, was going to figure out who it was supposed to go to, and then figured out she was detailing a gruesome rape and gave it to the authorities. So good job, post office clerk.
So, honestly,
she led the authorities, Maria, she led the authorities back to Peter's home, which was extremely ironic for Peter because she was spared by Peter because she insisted she couldn't remember his address. He said, do you know where I live? And she said, no, I don't remember where you live. And he said, are you sure you don't know where I live? And he said, yeah, I don't remember where you live. And she was obviously lying. So basically, she takes the police to Peter's apartment where the landlady is like, what's going on? And Maria's like, this is a man who raped me and tried to kill me. What's his name? Because she wasn't given his name. Where basically this landlady confirmed that the man that lived there was Peter Curtin. So now we're going to go into his arrest. So on the day that Maria led the officers to his apartment, he was not home, but he was on his way home. So he spotted her and the chief inspector in the hallway, like in the common hallway, and then immediately left. He was going to his house, like to his apartment. He saw them standing outside of his apartment or in the area, and he booked it because he was like, aw, crap, they put it together. They know who I am. They hadn't at the time known who he was, but he was like very paranoid, even though he was correct on being paranoid. He was very paranoid about how they knew who he was, what he had done. They were connecting it all together, correct? So basically, in his paranoia, he confessed to his wife that he had raped Maria. So this is the same wife that he married a while ago. Ooh, sorry, I'm trying to find her name. I want to say Augusta, but I feel like that's wrong. Sorry, I'm like reading real quick.
You're good.
I was right. It's August or Augusta. It's August with an E, pretty much. And I don't know if it's Augusta or Augusta. I'm saying Augusta. So basically, he confessed to his wife, Augusta Curtin, hey, I raped this woman. Her name is Maria. Do I have your blessing to live somewhere else until this all blows over? And this woman says yes. She doesn't go, you raped a woman? That's disgusting. What's wrong with you? This is also the same woman who stayed with him after he solicited a prostitute. Not that there's anything wrong with prostitutes. It's perfectly fine. But, like, he cheated on her, you know? So, it's the same woman.
Yeah.
So, basically, she gave him her blessing to live in another district of Dusseldorf. So, basically, kind of like another suburb of the city. And he left and did not come back for several days. So, on May 23rd, he confessed to his wife that he was the vampire of Dusseldorf. So before, he had just confessed, hey, I raped this one chick. That's it. No one else. That's all. That's it. And then she's like, okay, that's not that bad. I guess you've done it before with that other chick that I found out about. Fine. Go to another city until the sob blows over. I don't want to see you anyways. And then he comes back and confesses that he has done murders. He is this terrible person. And he tells his wife to collect the reward for his capture. And that is what she did. He told her to turn him in and get the reward. So she informed the police by phone that she was unaware of his capacity for his brutality, but also that he had confirmed doing the things, these awful things, and that he would confess to the police if they gave her the reward. So...
Oh, wow.
So basically, they agreed. He was arrested at gunpoint that afternoon. So, in total, Peter Curtin admitted to 68 crimes, 10 murders, and 31 attempted murders, with the rest being arson, burglary, and rapes. He made no excuses for his crimes, but insisted that he didn't torture his child victims, even though he definitely did.
Yeah, no.
He reported.
Sorry, guys, I had to grab something.
You're good. So this is the reason that he is called the Vampire of Dusseldorf is that he reported that he had drank the blood from three different victims, with drinking so much from Maria Hahn that he vomited. Do you know how much blood you have to drink to vomit?
Probably
you can. You can. Much. Your your stomach can handle up to at least a pint. That means he drank more than a pint of blood. Do you know how many? That's how much blood you give when you're donating.
Yeah. We have 10 pints of blood.
But still, like, yeah. Anyways, so the best part about this is that Peter Curtin was deemed by several psychologists as sane and completely in control of his actions, and that he even appreciated how evil his actions were deemed by other people. Therefore, he was legally sane and competent to stand trial. So, Curtin spent the duration of his trial in a heavily guarded iron cage that was shoulder high in order to keep him from attacking the relatives of his victims. So, basically, this dude was escorted into court and placed in a cage, which is terrifying to me. Like, it's just outwardly scary. You know what I mean? Like, imagine seeing a guy like Ted Bundy walk into the court and be placed in a cage that is his shoulder length, that's shoulder high, because he was that violent that he would attack. Like, that's scary.
Yeah.
Anyways, so on April 22nd of 1931, so a little over a year since he was captured and arrested, Curtin was found guilty and sentenced to death on 9 counts of murder and 7 counts of attempted murder. So he didn't get as much as he deserved, but it was still enough to prosecute him. So basically, July 1st, 1931, Peter Curtin was given his last meal of Wiener Schnitzel, which is like this fried delicacy in Germany. It actually looks really good. It's like, it's kind of like fancier fried chicken, but not quite. I don't really know how to describe it. You just have to look it up, but it looks good. Anyways, so he ate Wiener Schnitzel, white wine, and fried potatoes. And after he immediately ate all of that, he goes, "Can I have a second helping?" And they say yes. Which is the weirdest thing to me. It's like, he's a terrible murderer and has done all of these things to all of these people, and you're giving him second helpings? Like, it just doesn't make any sense to me. And it's on it, like, in some instances, it's just morbidly funny. So, anyways. Sorry, my thing did a weird thing. Anyways, so the next morning, July 2nd, at 6 in the morning, the Vampire of Dusseldorf was executed. Are you ready for what he was executed by? Yes, guillotine. The beauty of the French. So he is famously known for one of his last words being that of, are you ready? This is the quote. I saw this quote on something, and this is the reason that I did him today. Because it was just an eerie, like, one of his last words. So, are you ready?
What was it?
All right. So, this is what he said. Uh-huh. As his head was being laid on the little divot where they chop your head off, "Tell me, after my head is chopped off, will I still be able to hear, at least for a moment, the sound of my own blood gushing from the stump of my neck? That would be the pleasure to end all pleasures." Ugh.
What?
Like, it makes me cringe. That is just, that's what he's thinking. He's not sorry. He's not anything. He just wants to know if he's gonna get a boner from hearing his own blood. Ugh. Anyways, so after being asked if he had any actual last words, he looked up at his executioner, smiled, and said, "No." So, Peter Curtin's head was taken and dissected to see if they could see any abnormalities to explain his wicked deeds, and they found none. His head, as of now, is on display in Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum in Wisconsin Dells, Wisconsin. So if you ever want to go to Wisconsin, now you have a reason why. Basically, they put it in, preserving liquids, Like, you know all those old museums that have, like, those weird things in jars? That's what his head's in.
Mm-hmm.
To kind of, like, preserve it. And that's it. That is the vampire of Dusseldorf. That's the monster of Dusseldorf. And, yeah, he's a disgusting human being. And I feel like it's a great thing that he was beheaded, because that is very fitting for him. Because, you know, he strangled women. So, yeah, that's my story. I hope it got your murder fix for you guys, because there was plenty of that in there. Yeah.
Well, on that note, guys, don't forget to listen to our sister podcast, Our Inner Thoughts. Both shall be released Saturday, December 19th. So if you're hearing this, it's already out, and go listen to it, because we're going to be talking about Christmas traditions.
It's pretty interesting. We've got some cool things, and as promised, I made sure I did Krampus, because it's just such an interesting little tidbit of German history. And that's also another reason why I did a German serial killer today, because I figured, you know, relation. So, yeah. I hope you guys have a great Christmas.
We will not be releasing a podcast next week, just because we record on Friday nights, and next Friday night's going to be Christmas. And before that, the only other available time I have, at least, is going to be Christmas Eve, because I work literally
and
every single day.
And I have plans on Christmas Eve. So unfortunately, you guys will not be graced by our beautiful voices next week, but that does not stop you from going back and listening to any of our other episodes. I think this is our fourth one, correct? Fourth or fifth?
I think it's fifth.
So we either have three or four episodes for you to go back and listen to if you haven't already listened to them. So you could totally go listen to those. And this week we will be releasing our ninth, I believe, episode of Our Inner Thoughts. So you guys have plenty of material to go listen to if you miss our sultry voices. So yeah, we'll see you in 2 weeks pretty much. And
Just one second.
I wasn't ending anything. You're
no, I know. But I'm just trying to figure this out.
I tell you, but I can't.
I know.
We're just gonna go with this is the fifth one, and if we're wrong, then we're wrong. And that would actually, guys, give you.
I think it's the fifth, because I covered Monique Daniels, and then I covered Joan Riesch, and then I covered somebody else in between all of
this. I don't remember.
Who did I cover?
That's kind of bad, though. I remember last week I did Charles Sobhraj, though, and I don't remember who you did with that. I feel like it was another disappearance.
It was a disappearance. I did Terry Missy Beavers or whatever. Yeah, I did her. And then I did, so this is our fifth, because after that I did Dahmer, and today I did
So we figured it out. All right, cool. So, so we hope you have a great holiday, guys.
Tune in.
Well,
we should be back before New Year's.
We should be back before. Wait, no, we're going to be after New Year's.
No,
we
won't.
New Year's on, like.
So.
Oh, wait, I like.
New Year's is on a Friday. So our next
podcast. That is true. So we're not going to get to talk to you guys for the rest of the year. But alrighty, so I hope.
Have a wonderful Christmas and New Year's, and
I hope you guys have great holidays. Have fun. Don't die. Bye, guys.